location where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
The benefits of freedom. We are all meant to fit into society and feel society helps us in return. One is meant to work in return for money, this being a means of exchange through which goods and services may be purchased. Work is supposedly a producer of wealth, which then allows expenditure on its products. There is little alternative to this cycle, except through inherited wealth or total poverty, either of which remove one from the process of working for one's keep. The first option might be envied, the second pitied. If the wealth is obtained by illegal or disreputable means, such as crime, it might be scorned or despised. If the poverty is caused through laziness rather than misfortune, it will be met with equal disrespect. Most of us are somewhere in the middle and as such are compelled to take part in the working world, whether through the commercial sector, for a company, corporation or self-employment, or a paid but unprofitable sector, such as the civil service, public health care or politics. As such, we are granted a merit point. We are economically productive citizens, unlike those who drain the system, whether the unemployed or disabled, each of whom claim benefits with respectively differing criteria. In Britain, the unemployed are currently given the involuntary moniker of job seeker if they claim their apportioned money from the state. This job seeker's allowance requires one to visit a government office each fortnight where paperwork is signed that states one has done no productive work in that period, or if one has, a minimal amount. The claimant must also confirm they have undertaken specified activity to find work or be subject to a range of increasingly draconian sanctions. The system is administered by low-level civil servants known as employment advisers, who spend all day in an office building seeing perhaps 20 claimants, or clients, a day at 20-minute intervals. The whole procedure has a rigid formality with the pretense of cordiality veiling the very real sanctions that can occur. Take a typical office of this kind, a concrete bunker-like building where all moves in, out and around the place are chaperoned, watched or recorded. Men in white shirts banter by the door, nodding one past a receptionist to another white-shirted man, whose sole function is to ask the time of one's appointment. If this is out by more than 10 minutes in either direction, further admission is denied. Access is then granted to another area where another white-shirted operative takes one's claimant card. This card evokes the identity paperwork carried under a repressive regime and is brought to one's advisor by the white-shirted intermediary. Once its validity has been confirmed, one will be asked to join the advisor for the 20-minute appointment. During this, a booklet of agreed activity is scrutinised. A certain number of relevant steps must have been undertaken in order to find work or, in theory, a sanction can be invoked. This can involve the stopping of payment for several weeks. Despite their role as advisers, the government employees seldom offer potential jobs to the clients. Their role is largely a passive one, ensuring the required checks have been carried out in the name of scrutiny. Jobs are displayed on computer terminals in the foyer, which the clients must access for themselves. As such, the advisor is little more than a functionary, a cog in a bureaucratic system, unable to act freely within that system or make changes to its procedure. It is a system on which they depend themselves, for, as with claimants, their money comes from the government. This ultimately means the taxpayer, but is named a wage rather than a benefit. Thus, the advisor's activity is defined as work, even though no product has been created and no discernible service rendered beyond the administration of the system itself. Advisors frequently tell claimants to broaden their job search, in other words, become more flexible or versatile. Claimants must evolve or be trained in whatever way suits the system, yet the advisors are sheltered from the outside world and possess a very narrow focus. Their skills are not particularly great, a certain degree of computer literacy and what is often called customer care, but practice in such a regulated environment that there is little surprise to challenge them. Claimants might reflect on how well an advisor would fare if thrust onto the job market in a regime of compulsory diversification. So, what of the white-shirted men who also populate the building, enjoying their banter by the door? A black and red emblem is embroidered on their shirts, and may be identified if one can go close enough. It is the logo of G4S, the security company once known as Group 4. Again, each of these operatives receives money from the government for their designated tasks. In this case, it is the over-systematic shepherding of claimants around a most unloved building, implying their status as equivalent to other clients of G4S. The same company guards the accused on trial in a courtroom, or those entering a custody suite or police cells. In each case, the terminology of customers, advisors, and agreements has supplanted blunter but more honest terms for the involuntary situations involved. In a spiritual sense, the scenario is highly depressing. One knows the falsity of the relationships involved and can sense it when visiting a job centre or job centre plus, as they are now termed. Quite what the plus refers to is never made clear. The procedures involve a mechanistic approach to existence, an obsession with punctuality, even for petty or uninspiring appointments, and a contrived friendliness between advisor and client. In truth, this masks the underlying tension that must exist when one party has power and one does not. However, the advisor is equally trapped. While ostensibly a civil servant working at the Dole Office or Department of Work and Pensions, the job is hardly a rung on a gleaming Whitehall ladder, lacking any glamour, independence or career progression. The trappings of 9-to-5 are dominant in a setting that remains dreary despite the cosmetic makeover these offices have been given, along with the word plus. There are sofa-style seats for waiting clients, although few would wish to linger, and coloured dividers like the decor of a high street boutique. The security guards are always there, hovering in their uniform shirts while advisors wear civilian attire. Perhaps the staff has sacrificed the now for the reward of retirement, which can only come after several decades. The time would need to be justified as an act of selflessness, serving a greater good and not asking questions. To understand would be too much to bear, knowing one is just a cog for life and paid a wage in compensation. Society says these operatives are valid citizens with jobs and scorns the unemployed with a negative prefix. However, such distinctions are drawn in the interests of the system. One can have a pointless job and be valued, or do unpaid activity but be scorned. Work on an environmentally destructive project may be valued, but campaigning against it is not. The operatives have wages, but are trapped in servitude. The claimants have benefits, but a measure of freedom. So who has the better deal? At least claimants can return quickly to the outside world, with all its events, uncertainties and coincidences. The days of an operative are fixed, unvaried and deadening. In a sense, the crude images of rich man, poor man still have a distant relevance. The rich man in his office, the poor man on the street, even if riches are the wages of servitude and poverty the benefits of freedom.
The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.